Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Michael Hawley. It's Tuesday.
That is correct. Hi, Al.
Hey, another day, and then it's holiday time.
That's right. Hawley Day.
Hawley Day.
See, you're going to enjoy that and call it Hawley Day.
Yeah, no, I'm going to stay away from Holly. Now, let's see. I see you've been pushing your reruns of History's Greatest Mysteries on TV.
That is correct. So that was on last night. So, of course, I had to take a picture of me with that again. And so,
yeah. And I was, when people ask me, I say, you probably got it on running 24/7.
Yes, yeah, it's DVR. I don't tell anybody.
Well, today we're going to be talking to a writer here that gets into history. So we've got the new book called The Lost Pope, and it's Mr. Glenn Cooper. So thank you for being here, Glenn.
I am delighted to be here, Al and Michael.
Nice speaking with you.
Glenn, you haven't been on the show before, so let's talk a little bit about you.
All right.
You've got quite the history of education and all sorts of stuff going on. Let's talk about your background a little. Where did you come from, and what do you do?
I like to say that I'm kind of on my third act in life. I've done a bunch of things before becoming a full-time working writer. I started off studying archaeology at college, and for a time I thought I was going to be a professional archaeologist. That didn't work out. I took a different fork in the road and went into medicine. Instead, and became a physician and internal medicine, infectious diseases specialist.
Nice.
And then took another detour into research, and I did pharmaceutical and biotech research at a number of companies before becoming the CEO of a few biotech companies, and did that for a whole bunch of years, and but always had a real burning urge, desire to write. When I was, having serious day jobs, I wrote screenplays because they seemed a lot kind of more accessible than novels for a busy guy. And I wrote about 20 screenplays mostly in my 40s and early 50s, and I was spectacularly unsuccessful as a screenwriter. I never wanted to move to LA. I never wanted to really get into that whole scene of selling yourself. A bunch of scripts got optioned. One got made, so 1 out of 20, not terrible, I guess. And I was about to start my, 21st or 22nd screenplay, another thing that was going to be completely unproducible, big budget studio kind of a thing. And I said, I just can't do this to myself anymore. I'm going to try it as a novel. And that one hit, believe it or not. It was harder getting an agent than getting a publisher when I had that lined up. And there's a good story there, by the way. And when I had that lined up, it wasn't too long before the damn thing sold in 30 different countries, seven figures, This book wound up selling 4 million copies. It was called Library of the Dead. And I said, you know what? I think it's time for the third act. So I became a writer.
Now, how do you choose your subject? Like, I know in the new book, The Lost Pope, you've got a theology professor at Harvard, and you deal in religious thriller, let's just say, the best way to call it. What made you go that direction?
Well, it was kind of interest informs most of my choices. Things, if I'm not super interested in a topic, I just can't do a good job at it. And I've always been interested in archaeology and history, especially European history, especially the history of the church in Europe. And it's really impossible to be interested in European history without getting into the machinations of the Vatican for the last 2,000 years. And this book, The Lost Pope, is the seventh in a loosely non-serial group of books with a similar, with the same protagonist, a guy named Cal Donovan, who's a professor of the history of religion at the Harvard Divinity School. And Harvard was my alma mater, so I kind of know that scene pretty well. And he's a real interesting guy. Charismatic. He's a brilliant academic. He's not bad looking. He's got a lot of vices, a lot of demons. I like writing kind of complicated, realistic kind of characters. And he, over the course of several books, has befriended a series of recent popes and has become known as the Pope Whisperer, someone who can be a friend to popes without really getting too involved in the politics of the Vatican, because the Vatican is a pretty opaque organization with a lot of fiefdoms, and he operates outside of these fiefdoms, and the Pope likes to bring him in to help solve some thorny mysteries.
So is Cal agnostic, atheist? What is Cal?
Cal is half Jewish, half Catholic. His father was a famous old kind of Boston Irish Catholic professor at Harvard himself in his day. His mother was a flamboyant New York Jewish philanthropist, and he grew up really with I don't know if it was one foot in either camp or neither foot in either camp, but eventually, later in life, he, because of his interest as an academic and interest in the European Catholicism, he decides to become a practicing Catholic. But he always has a lot of dualism. His very name reflects that. His parents argued all the time, and they couldn't decide what to do in terms of his religious background. They even fought about his name, and he took Donovan, obviously, was a Catholic name. His middle name was Abraham, as a nod to his mother, and they decided to compromise on his first name, Calvin, and so it's Calvin Abraham Donovan, which spells out CAD, and that a lot of women over the years would have thought of him a bit of a CAD, although he gets tamer as time goes on.
We all do, I think. So when you do something like this, you're writing in a thriller in a religious sort of theme, with fiction and nonfiction, in a sense, because there's going to be realistic things to it as well as fictional things. How do you decide what gets put in and what doesn't, and what you fictionalize?
Yeah, so I, unlike some other authors, I don't usually start a book with a plot point or a set of plot goals. I usually start with an idea that interests me, whether it's a religious idea or a philosophical idea, something about science, something about the intersection between science and faith. And once I have a larger theme that I'm interested in, I'll kind of narrow it down and work on work on the plot. And because all of my books are rooted in history, I try like heck to make them as historically accurate as possible, the parts that are rooted in real history.
So lots of research.
Tons of research. And boy, it's the best part of being a writer from my point of view, because writing is hard, but research is reading. And I love to read. I've always been attracted to libraries. I've got a pretty fair library myself that I've accumulated over the years, and I'll spend a few months just reading books and getting deliveries from Amazon and going to libraries and, you know, just have a field day. So for this current book, Lost Pope, I probably read all or part of 30 primary and secondary source books, dozens and dozens of articles on early Christianity, on the apostles, on Mary Magdalene, on first century Rome and first century Israel.
Sounds like Gnosticism as well.
Yeah. Greek and Coptic biblical papyri, forgeries of ancient papyri, the biblical and non-biblical gospels, Egyptian burial practices, women's role in the church, you name it. So deep dive into a lot of topics, and then, you know, lace the fiction into it, wrap it all in a hopefully a page turning thriller.
Especially with Mary Magdalene, that's a kind of a pivotal person right there.
She's a really interesting character who, I'm certainly not the first writer who's settled on Mary as a character, but she's so ripe for exploration because she's so enigmatic. You know, she's actually mentioned more in the Gospels than any of the apostles, which is kind of a mind-boggling fact. She's the second most mentioned woman in the New Testament, behind Christ's mother, and she's the only person present at both the crucifixion and the resurrection. And it's only a lot later in church history that she sort of gets tarred and feathered as being a woman of ill repute. This is dates to the 6th century after Christ in the Common Era, where a pope named Gregory the First got up and gave a sermon that painted her with the brush of a harlot. He probably had some agenda that he was trying to get forward, but she probably wasn't that woman at all. So I envision a different kind of historical role for her.
Yeah, I think the open grave with the angel speaking with her as well, I think that she's definitely more pivotal than some probably want.
Than a lot of the minor characters, the guys who are not A-list talent. They're more, some of the apostles were B-list.
Yes.
Do you have a subtext or a point when a reader picks up this book and reads it, and at the end of it, besides the thrilling aspects and some of the entertainment parts of it, and even some of your research and history, is there like a subtext or a meaning that you hope people take away from it?
There is, and that subtext really was the engine that led me to write the book in the first place, and that is to explore and have people ask questions about the historical and the modern role of women in the church, because it's kind of an outlier in terms of a lot of mainstream religions in terms of women in the hierarchy. I remember early on when I was doing a lot of primary research for earlier books in my career, maybe my fourth or fifth book, I can't remember, it was called The Devil Will Come, and it introduced a character that's been prominent in a lot of these Cal Donovan books, the nun Elisabetta Celestino, and I introduced her in this book, and I started visiting the Vatican and developing contacts and getting some pretty interesting access to people and places, non-public places within the Vatican.
Like their library? Yeah, that would be awesome.
You know, thanks for mentioning that. At the end of the first Cal Donovan book, for helping the then Pope work through his thorny problems, Pope Celestine, his name was, he awarded Cal with something that no non-Vatican employee has, namely browsing rights of the Vatican Secret Archives and the Vatican Library. Because if you go there and you're an academic, you go to a reading room of either one of the places and you basically submit books and texts and manuscripts you want to see, and they'll run off and they'll bring them to you, right, in the reading room. But no one's allowed to go and actually wander around from the outside other than our hero, Cal Donovan. And that's really created a whole bunch of fantastic plot ideas. You know, there are miles and miles of stacks, you know, underground and then various towers and structures within the Vatican, where you could literally get lost and never want to be found, because you're just in hog heaven if you're a book person. So I've not gotten past the reading room myself, unfortunately, but I've imagined going past a lot of times. So I asked people in my naivete early on, so tell me about the roles of women here in the Vatican. And I'm sitting here in some Monsignor's office or some Archbishop's office. And I always got met with this kind of blank stare back, you know, what are the role of women? Well, it boiled down to, it's changed a lot under Francis, Pope Francis, but at least in the recent past, it's boiled down to, well, they do they operate the Xerox machines and get coffee. And that is kind of astonishing, you know, really, if you look at the significant role of women have in the, you know, within various Protestant denominations, within the Jewish religion. You know, the church was just one minor step ahead of, I suppose, you know, Islam and Greek Orthodox in terms of how women are treated. So this has been a subject that's continued to interest me, and over the course of these Cal Donovan books, Elisabetta Celestino has risen into roles that women have not to date risen to. She was made the president of the Congregation for Sacred Archaeology. She had an archaeology background, and in the current book, The Lost Pope, the American Pope John has elevated her to become the Vatican Secretary of State, which is a position that has always historically gone to a cardinal. It's not written into canon law that it has to be a cardinal or even a priest. So he uses this loophole and he makes her Secretary of State, and she gets it's a very controversial thing, and she's vilified by the conservative factions within the church. And I wanted to play out her trials and tribulations in modern times with the trials and tribulations of a possible early female pope who was lost to history. Because, you know, the early bishops of Rome, the early popes after Peter, are really shrouded in the mists of time. It's the first histories of the early 10 popes or so was written 200 years after the fact, so it's not really clear who the second and the third popes were. So could one of them have been a female pope who was also vilified and was erased from history? And that's kind of counterpoint historical to modern really is what I'd like people to think about after the last pages is turned.
So who is Cal Donovan? Like, where did you come up with the character, and what's your relationship with Cal Donovan?
Well, you know, I like most writers, you know, protagonists tend to be somewhat autobiographical. I've written a couple of series, trilogies, really. This is my, Cal Donovan is my longest series. I've just finished the seventh in that series. And the first protagonist was an FBI agent, okay? And I am definitely not an FBI guy. He had a lot of my personality and characteristics, but in terms of what he did, no way. My second guy was a soldier named John Camp in a trilogy called the Down Trilogy, a bit of a historical fantasy, a trilogy about a real journey to hell and back. And I am definitely not a soldier either. Cal Donovan has the similar personality traits to those protagonists and similar to me, I suppose, in a lot of ways. But he's closest to me because I have more of an academic background. I spend more time in libraries than I do anywhere else. And
so a bibliophile, both of you.
We're both bibliophiles. You know, we both spent a lot of years in school. And so I suppose he's not me, of course, but he's the most similar to me, and I feel very, very comfortable with him. And I've been married for getting on to 50 years. He's never been married, but he's had an interesting evolution over the course of these books because he has fallen in love with this nun. After being a serial womanizer, a serial relationship guy, he's finally met his match in a woman that is basically unobtainable, and that creates some real changes in his character as time goes on. So there's a lot of meaty stuff to work with a character like that.
So is Elisabetta in conflict as well?
Well, yes, but she's more stalwart than he is. Although we shall see what happens in the future, right?
That's right.
When you loosely base a lot of books on a character and kind of their the things they're going through, the mysteries or whatever they go through, do you sort of yourself keep some sort of a ledger or a Bible, as they call it in the writing world, to kind of keep track of characters and what they do throughout the books?
I, you know what? If I had it to do over again, I would have done just that.
Yeah.
You know, because I never really knew that I would extend him so long. And now I forget what he's done, where he's been, what he's thought, what he said, and it's a real pain in the backside to have to reread the stuff to figure out. Now, if I'm going to be accurate with my real history, I better damn well be accurate about my own manufactured history, because I have readers who find mistakes. They love finding mistakes.
Cal has blue eyes, not brown eyes.
Yeah, exactly. And I get stick all the time every time I make a mistake. It's kind of fun, I guess.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I guess you must be surprised sometimes at what readers will kick out in one of your books, or even believe what you're trying to say in a book. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I write about controversial stuff because when you write about religious topics, unless you're you know, steeped in dogma, you know, you're going to be ruffling feathers. You know, I've touched on some pretty difficult subjects, but I know that my stuff is especially popular in Catholic countries. I mean, I do pretty well in the U.S., but most of my sales are in Italy, Spain, and France. Probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 to 1, and most of my readers, you know, because of those demographics, are Catholic, whether they're practitioners or not, you know, it depends. And I know I have a lot of readers within the clergy and within the Vatican.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I get a lot of comments, but usually people seem to enjoy being challenged a little bit. I haven't gotten any death threats, if you know, or equivalent to a fatwa.
No, sound bit rusty or anything.
Yeah, no, well, you know, there are certain religions where you can't take liberties, you know.
Yeah.
And Christianity isn't one of them, I guess.
Well, so where do you see yourself going then? Like you said, you didn't really initially think you were going to go this far with this character and this whole.
I didn't think I would go so far as a novelist, period. I got to pinch myself, you know, with regularity. I'm now starting to do research on my 21st book.
Nice.
And in 15 years. So this has been kind of a modern miracle, that I've been, you know, blessed with being successful, in something that I find thoroughly enjoyable. You know, I really like the solitary practice of writing novels as opposed to the collaborative process of making movies. So what I like to do is write one or two Cal Donovan books and then kind of a palate cleanser and do something completely different. And the one I'm working on right now conceptually is completely different, and that just makes it more fun, keeps it fresh.
In the future, is there going to be something about the Library of Alexandria that you guys find, or you find, or something to that effect?
I've been trying to figure out a good Library of Alexandria plot for a while, because it's what a terrific wonder that was.
Right.
I haven't really been an Egyptologist. I've always been interested in Egyptology, but never really could consider myself a student of Egyptology. Certainly never a Wilbur Smith kind of a guy.
Right.
May he rest in peace. but yeah, that's definitely always been there in my job jar.
So one of the interesting librarians there was Eratosthenes. So if you're ever going to have one, I want him involved. So I'm going to get that book.
Okay, I don't know him.
He's the one that determined the circumference of the Earth.
Okay.
Here's 1492 when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Everybody thought the Earth was flat, but he did it 300 BC or something. He figured out the exact circumference of the Earth, just a few miles off. So he's an amazing guy.
Well, funnily enough, that's the era that I'm interested in the next book, which is very loosely based on the fantastic invention, probably the first computer, the anti-Kithara mechanism.
Oh, yes, yes.
Which I don't know how much you guys know about that, but it is one of the great wonders of the ancient world. It's even a wonder of the modern world, to be honest. It's an incredible device that was that's over 2,000 years old. That was found in an ancient shipwreck at the turn of the 20th century. A fantastically complex bronze mechanism for determining the orbits of planets, eclipses of the sun and the moon, much more advanced than anyone believed that the early Egyptians, that the early Greeks could have been. So we're constantly making little discoveries and large discoveries about how our forebears were much more advanced than we give them credit.
Well, yeah.
Just think if they discovered the information in that library, that would just be amazing.
You know what? You just gave me an idea for that.
All right. Yes.
There you go. You go.
I'm going to tell people I helped out Glenn.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, because the modern world's starting to think the world's flat again. So, you know, it's we're having these issues going back in time. People are crazy. You know?
What if the Library of Alexandria weren't destroyed? What if it actually was hidden? It's intact. It's discovered. Blah, blah, blah.
Oh, I love it. I love it.
There you go. Well, it to me, it sounds like each one of these books, it's not just a thriller book. It's very important to you. And I can't help but think you put a lot into it. And at that point, each time you release one of these books, get it to the publisher, you've got to have noticed or realized some change in yourself about going through a process of one of these books.
Yeah, I mean, I still, in some level, am amazed when I get to the end of one of these books because it feels when you start, you just have a concept, an idea. It feels like you're kind of at the base camp of Everest. You know, you can't imagine you're ever going to be able to summit and then get back down. And every book that I finish, I kind of am overwhelmed by feeling of gratitude and personal accomplishment. And the stuff that I've learned doesn't go away; it stays with me. And knowledge changes you. And then when the books get birthed and they get out in the world, and people read them and start dialoguing with you, then that changes you too. And nothing has more of an impact on me than people, especially young people who say that they really weren't readers until they found my books, or they really weren't much interested in history before they found my books, or they didn't really think much about some of the subject matters that I kind of write about, like free will and predestination and the afterlife and how science and faith can coexist. So if I'm able to change people even in a small way, that changes me. So it's a whole process that starts with an idea and ends with a big kind of worldwide dialogue that I get to have with readers.
I would think that the setting as well is very important. Do you write the setting like a character, or are you creating them as a character?
Well, I try to be accurate with settings as accurate as I am with my history, and I'll dip into the bank of places that I've visited. I'll go and visit new places. The pandemic kind of threw a spanner in the works. The previous Cal Donovan book was based in Portugal, and Portugal was the only European country that I had never visited. It was kind of a gap, and I had to do all of my Portugal visiting in virtually online and with Google Maps and with this great virtual reality app, you know, you can use on, you know, the Meta Quest called Wander. I don't know if you're into virtual reality at all, but you can literally walk around in a 3D down streets of any city or town in the world.
That's cool.
You can't smell the smells, you know. You can't hear the sounds, but you can certainly see the sights, and that's been a great tool for me as a writer.
Yeah, sounds like it. Sometimes you don't want the smells anyway. Enough is, you know, you can, depends on the day and how hot it is. So listen, so are you active on social media, and are you, do you have a website set up, and do you like to interact with readers? And if so, how do they get a hold of you, or how do they find Glenn?
So I'm a bit of a nut on social media. I will try to answer people, whether it's on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. I'll try to answer within minutes, if not hours, of getting pinged. And I just I don't mind being interrupted. It just keeps me going, keeps me fresh all day. You know, talking to people. So yeah, I'm in all the usual places, on social media. I've got a website, glenncooperbooks.com, that's got all of my stuff on it. Yeah, I'll probably spend half an hour a day on social media.
Yeah, you don't want to get too lost. You'll start thinking the pandemic never happened. And
well, not that kind of social media. I mean, I'm
yeah, you have to be careful out there, right? You know,
that's right.
It's dangerous.
Yeah, you know, that's a sore subject as an old infectious diseases hand. The pandemic deniers, vaccine anti-vaxxers. Boy, don't get me started.
No, but the whole thing, you know, as a writer, and when you're writing and trying to make a realistic story and try to make characters as real as possible, and you want people to read it and come through it and kind of go, yeah, you know, feel that person could be real, like what they're doing and saying and how they're acting. It makes sense, like the story. But you have to think over the last 3-4 years, and maybe it's just me, but the people in general, a lot of the behavior that we've seen in the public, especially over the pandemic, I found it to be very surprising. And maybe that's just my own ignorance, right? Maybe it's just I sort of didn't get what I expected. Sort of, I was surprised by things. And that's got to change you also as a writer, in a sense, because when you're writing, trying to write realistic characters, you've got to kind of go, ooh, you know, that's kind of strange, but this is how people are. So I don't know how that changed.
Well, I wasn't surprised. I was astonished.
yeah.
I mean, they're really, who could have possibly predicted that a large segment of society would react to a cataclysmic a species-threatening pandemic by becoming anti-science.
Yeah.
You know, it's the only sort of logical, rational way to approach it is that, gosh, we hope the scientists can find a way out of this mess.
Exactly.
So for it to turn the way it turned, it represents something that I think historians are going to be studying for a long, long time, because it represents something very bleak, very dark, and very counterintuitive in terms of an historical trend. When I was a kid, going through the polio epidemic,
right.
Yeah,
it was considered a patriotic act to get your kid vaccinated and to become vaccinated yourself.
Right.
And how it became anti-patriotic to do the same during a modern epidemic pandemic makes very, very little sense, at least to my scientific mind.
I think you're right, because that's it's the power of the limbic system over frontal lobes. Yes. So that doesn't make sense.
Yes, exactly. And I think, oh, maybe we can blame social media. Maybe it was always there, you know, and it just never got a megaphone before. If there were anti-vaxxers, you know, from the 1950s through the current era, then maybe they just didn't have a way of getting other people to listen to them, right?
Right.
And so it's maybe the underbelly of social media that at least caused it to propagate.
But it's just surprising that we should be overall more intelligent and more, I don't know, I guess they say that critical thinking, but we should be more intelligent than what we were 50 years ago as a species, right? We should be better off, and we should be able to handle things better than that, I would think. Like, it's just in my thinking, that's how it was. And so that's why I was surprised.
The science has gotten better and better, and we've gotten so much more advanced in biomedical sciences and physical sciences and physics, you name it. The advances are fantastic, but from a societal point of view, we've just gotten dumber and dumber. And it's a strange disconnect. There's a marvelous a spoof movie called Idiocracy. I think Mike Judge about a future world where society has gotten so dumb, inbred stupid. It's a comedy, by the way. That people just can't even take care of themselves on a basic level.
Right.
And a guy from the present, who's a very ordinary intelligence, gets projected into the future, and it becomes the smartest man in the world, and it's hysterically funny, but also depressing because it's taking it's like actually. It
sounds like a documentary of the last election there. I don't know. Get into trouble here. I'll get screamed at.
See.
Well, Glenn, it's been a real pleasure, and we wish you the best on the book. Of course, now the book is called The Lost Pope, and it's a thriller, and our guest is the author of that, and that's Glenn Cooper. So thank you for being on the show, Glenn.
This was a great hour for me. Thank you, Al. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, great speaking with you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.